What's up, Open Floor Globe? This is Ben Golver with the Washington Post. I am joined on the other line by Michael the Pod Pina. Michael, we have NBA playoff games to dissect. We are recording this on a Thursday, so we won't have Thursday night's results between the Blazers and the Lakers and the Thunders and the Rockets, but we've sure got plenty to get through from the first few days of action. We've had one team, the Philadelphia 76ers, basically check themselves out of the postseason. They're already halfway home, I believe. We've got some other teams emerging as potential championship contenders. We've got panic among the number one seeds, all sorts of good stuff. Michael, I want to start with something that I hinted at on the last episode, which is the Lakers fans are not the biggest fans of the Pod Pina right now. They're not down with MPP. And Tyler summed it up, all right? He said, "Dear Michael Pina, there is still time for you to repent for your scorching take that the Trailblazers are going to upset the Lakers. The king loves his sinners and offers absolution for those who confess. Confess that you are not an objective NBA reporter, but a green-blooded Celtics fan. Confess that you have no objectivity when it comes to the Lakers. Confess that you are a prisoner of the moment. Confess that you're still salty about LeBron's 45-point masterpiece in 2012 against your Celtics. Physicists are still not sure whether or not your takes are hotter than the surface of the sun, and I have submitted grant applications to the National Science Foundation to secure funding to study this. Confess, Michael Pina, and be forgiven, or your dear Rockets will be struck down by the Thunder." So, Michael, he sent this in, obviously, before Game 1, which did not go the Lakers' way whatsoever. The Blazers take that one. Lakers can't get any shooting from their supporting cast. LeBron puts a massive stat line, but you know, ultimately was outplayed by Damian Lillard down the stretch. Anthony Davis took a lot of heat from various corners for maybe being a little bit too passive and not quite in beast mode against Portland's front line. So I imagine you're ready to come and really just swing back as hard as possible against Tyler and the other Laker haters out there. Michael, would you like to take a victory lap now? Would you like to delay it later in the series? I think it's you and Charles Barkley right now who are the two loudest anti-Lakers voices in the world. That's good company to be in, Michael. So what do you have to say for yourself?
I was about to bring up Charles Barkley and just say I'm not quite ready to take out the broom and start sweeping my apartment with it. But I will say that nothing that I saw from the Lakers in that game particularly surprised me. Their offense was atrocious. It was the fourth worst offensive outing that they've had all season long. And two of those other games were earlier this month. So there's clearly a problem. And, I did not expect them to flip the switch. They're not that talented of a team. They have not proven anything. It's basically just LeBron James and Danny Green who have championship experience on that roster. I'm still confident in picking the Blazers because their offense hums. They have Dame Lillard, who's still the hottest player in the bubble. And I think there are some adjustments, one or two minor ones that the Lakers might be able to make. But at the end of the day, like if you do not have 3-point shooting that the opponent respects in this day and age, then you can't really win. And right now, the Lakers do not have 3-point shooting that their opponent respects.
So diplomatic, Michael. Come on. I was hoping for some more haymakers from you. Maybe they'll come out as we get going. You're just getting warmed up. And my takeaway from Game 1, and I wrote this for the Washington Post, is that LeBron made the comment the Blazers aren't your typical 8 seed. And I believe that's true. I mean, you look at the guys that they're welcoming back from a health standpoint. You look at the momentum that they're carrying right now. You look at Damian Lillard just playing out of this world, seeding game MVP in the bubble. It is fair to say that they're not a typical 8 seed. But I think when you look at the Lakers, they are not playing like a 1 seed in the bubble whatsoever. Like the kinds of things we expect from 1 seeds would be control and poise in clutch situations. And you see they blow multiple defensive assignments, giving up wide open 3-pointers to Portland in game 1. We would expect them to come out with a vengeance and a bang in game 1 of the playoffs, right? Instead, they get way behind early on that game. Portland kind of takes it to them. We would expect them to have a really balanced and versatile offensive attack, not being overly reliant upon certain players. You look back at the most recent champions, you know, whether it's Toronto, Golden State, you know, even Cleveland itself back in 2016, there was much better offensive balance and more proven weapons on those teams than there are on these Lakers. And so, you know, you add all of those things up, you know, it was a performance. I'm not sure if they left that one panicked, but I did sense some concern and just some down body language, some frustration. I think some maybe even confusion or looking like they were surprised, kind of got punched in the mouth and didn't expect it. And I think it winds up really putting, it goes back to LeBron, doesn't it? Doesn't he have to kind of take control of this series, find a way to you know, get the Lakers offensive going, whether that's himself just going to the basket more often, whether that's himself working out of the post and trying to generate offense that way, whether it's, you know, him and AD just doing a two-man game, play after play after play after play to hope you can generate enough offense there. I'm not sure he's going to be able to find the help no matter how long he looks at guys like Kyle Kuzma, Danny Green, and Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. Like, I think if that's your game plan, hey, we need those guys to step up, that's pretty rough, and that's not sustainable over the course of an entire postseason run, let alone a series against a team that's really locked in and playing together like Portland.
Yeah, that's really well said, and when I mentioned adjustments that they can make, I think, you know, I think LeBron to the post is the most obvious one. He really didn't post up at all in that game, and when he did, it was kind of a disaster. You know, they tried to run some pick and roll with him and AD, and Portland is just like aggressively packing the paint. Like, they are not, you know, there was one or two instances where AD got free on a roll and got to the rim, and good for him. But I think for the majority, every time they tried to run a pick and roll in the half court, you know, Portland is just like, everybody on the team has 2 feet in the paint, and they don't care about Kyle Kuzma. They don't care about Alex Caruso. They don't care about Markieff Morris. Like, it's just, you can play AD at the five, which is the number one adjustment that I think a lot of people are saying that the Lakers can make. I personally just don't think it matters if your guards and your wings aren't good. And right now, the Lakers are really struggling in that department. So, you know, there are a couple adjustments that you can make, but fundamentally, Ben, I just look at this roster, and I think an emailer sent something in similar where it's just, it's constructed because the way it is in a detrimental fashion because Anthony Davis did not want to play center in the first place. So you have JaVale McGee, you have Dwight Howard, you have, you know, DeMarcus Cousins, who they signed in the last offseason. And so that's trouble. Like, you need 3-point shooting. And it's kind of remarkable that they had the success that they did during the regular season and none of these flaws really presented themselves. But these are real issues. And when you're in the thick of a playoff series, it's kind of too late to correct them.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at their regular season run, they were just in a real joyride and groove. I mean, they were playing with awesome momentum at home, and so much of what the Lakers were doing was almost like riding that Staples Center crowd. It was truly fun to be at a Lakers game for the first time in my 5 years covering the Lakers in Los Angeles. Like, it was a show. There were celebrities courtside. LeBron was feeding off of it. Nobody milks a crowd and plays to the crowd like LeBron. And I think he's feeling the absence of a crowd more than any other player in the bubble. I think two things can be true. Every team has to adjust to the bubble conditions. That is true, and that's what everyone screams back at, you know, the Lakers every time that they raise these issues. That can be true. But also this idea that, like, at this point of his career, you know, LeBron has been so famous and so long for his entire adult life that he is just conditioned to receive that kind of positive feedback in a way that most players aren't. And when it's not there, I do think it impacts him more than it impacts a lot of other people. And he is showing it. You know, I think when you look at just how down he was after game one, how he's kind of searching, how they asked him, well, what did you do in between the seeding round and the playoffs? And he was like, absolutely nothing. There's nothing to do here. That's not the typical LeBron that we're used to, certainly not during the playoffs when he's so usually just laser focused, locked in, super competitive, only caring about, you know, trying to win. It was grumbles, Michael, and we just don't usually hear that. to me, that was a red flag. Now, I think ultimately he is going to have heard, you know, schmucks like us talking for 48 hours. He's going to have read and listened to all the peanut takes. And at some point, you know, the competitive desire is going to kick back in and we're going to see a better version of him. But what scares me with their shooting is how they're passing up open looks and double clutching a lot. You know, it's the pump fake party, as Lee Ellis of the Starters would call it. That's a red flag. I mean, that means those guys are not confident. They don't feel like they have trust in themselves, or they don't feel that LeBron has trust in them. You heard Frank Vogel even say, well, LeBron would have 20 assists if the guys would have made shots. Not sure that was a helpful comment. You know, if I'm one of those other players, it's like, oh, I see how it is. You know, we're all just out here trying to get him numbers and letting him down. It's kind of a tough framing on that one. So I think what they really need is Mike Miller on a Zoom call to just get preach them the let it fly mentality. You know, South Dakota's sensation Mike Miller, longtime NBA player, with that, you know, let it fly catchphrase. I think they need a little let it fly, except for KCP. For KCP, just don't let it fly. Just hold on to the basketball. Don't shoot. Everybody else, let it fly. Maybe Mike Miller can get through to him.
I like how this is the solution.
It goes back to what you said on the Blazers defense. If you don't stretch that defense, it's going to be ugly and too inefficient inside. You have to pull those guys out of the paint to some degree. So LeBron's got the driving lanes, in part because he has not looked as quick and nimble and explosive off the bounce in the bubble as he did before the shutdown, right? So you got to give him a little bit more room to work with. If you just compare visually LeBron attacking the paint to James Harden attacking the paint or Luka attacking the paint, those are probably the three premier ball handling playmakers in the league right now. If you just put pictures side by side of those three guys, LeBron's seeing twice as many bodies, sometimes three times as many bodies as in the paint as those other two guys are, because their offenses are much more spread out because they've got guys who can shoot. So you've got to get those shooters going or they're in trouble.
You know, what you just said in comparing LeBron with Harden and Luka made me think about how LeBron really didn't access the three-point line on his own to generate offense in game one at all. And he really hasn't done that too much in the bubble to begin with. Like, he's really just trying to get everybody else involved. His assist rate in game one was 72.7, which is just like, I don't even know how to process that number. But when you're like, I think about Harden and if he was on this team, how he would respond. And he's not just putting his head down and trying to get to the basket and get to the free throw line. He's going to do that a little bit, but primarily he's going to dribble 45 times per possession and launch step backs. And he's going to try to get to the free throw line and draw fouls that way. And he's going to drill some of those shots. And he's going to try to, open up the defense by himself in that way. And like, I don't think the answer is necessarily for LeBron to do that. He does have the step back three in his repertoire. But at the end of the day, I kind of don't think that we should be blaming him primarily for their woes. I mean, I look at the supporting cast. I look at the front office to put this team together. And to be honest, I look at Anthony Davis, who really, like, I don't know. We talked about LeBron posting up. AD didn't really post up at all either. And when he did, get the ball, you know, high post, even low post a little bit, he just, like, he takes so long to get going. He's not quick into his movements. He lets the double team come and then he kicks out. It's just very passive basketball. And when he does go quick, it's usually like a contested long two. Sometimes he'll draw a foul that way, but like, that's not, like, this is the playoffs. Like, you can't, that's just not what, especially with Gabriel guarding him, this is just not, it's not the way he should be approaching his own offensive game.
For sure. Look, let's wind back to October, and I'm telling you, game one of the playoffs, AD and LeBron are the one seed. AD is being guarded by Wenyen Gabriel, and you're anticipating what stat line? 45 and 20? I mean, what does that look like? And it's not just about the numbers with Davis. It's really about the impact and how he's getting it, like you're describing. And, you know, he spent last summer working a lot on the perimeter. He wanted to be a little bit more of a, you know, a dribble guy into his moves. He wanted to be more comfortable stepping out to the three-point shot. You know, and I do wonder, did all of that work and all of that attention maybe distract a little bit from some of the other areas that he could be, you know, truly devastating for opposing defenses? A lot of the complaints that I'm hearing about Anthony Davis this week give me real flashbacks to some of the complaints about LaMarcus Aldridge from some of his, you know, playoffs past. And that's not the company that, you know, people expected Anthony Davis to be in. And I think he could play better. He's actually had some moments here in the bubble where it's like, oh, wow, like this is the talented guy we've been talking about for the last 3 or 4 years, where, you know, he's giving you very few options of stopping him, and he's just an overwhelming force. That's the version they need here going forward in the series. They're in some serious jeopardy. And just to underscore that, Michael, I want to read an email from my buddy Caleb. He writes, "My name is Caleb, and I'm 13 years old. I watched the Lakers play the Blazers, and the way Dame and CJ took over the end of that game, I have to pick the Blazers in four. By the way, I'm loving the inside the bubble coverage, Ben." Caleb, I love the take. So, Michael, it's you, Caleb, and Charles Barkley together on the Blazers bandwagon. That seems like really good company to me, Michael. I think you're probably feeling pretty good about yourself. Let's take this from the Portland side. Isn't the scary part for the Lakers that the Blazers didn't even shoot that well? They didn't even play that well offensively. The game was played in LA style, wasn't it? It wasn't the big shootout that Portland had been involved in during their bubble rounds. And yet, in the fourth quarter, when it came time to execute, Portland was right there ready to do it. I think four different Blazers players, Dame, CJ, Carmelo, and Gary Trent Jr., all hit three-pointers in a 19-6 closing stretch. They actually played really tough and stout defense down the stretch, which I did not expect from these Blazers. And they just executed better on both ends. I guess, you know, if you're Portland, like, are you, they were feeling good about game one, obviously, but I don't think that they were feeling like they stole it. I think they just felt like they won it, and they still feel like they can play better.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I mean, you shoot 6 for 10 from the 3-point line in the fourth quarter, there's a good chance you're going to win the basketball game. And we should really talk about Dame for a second, who, I mean, some of the shots this guy is hitting, like that one where he goes, he's going to his left, pulls up from like 30 feet with AD, with a late contest in AD's face, and it just drills it. Like, I honestly don't even know what else there is to say about Dame. And, I mean, if you thought he was cool before, like, the fact that in the middle of crunch time, he's coming back to the other end, retreating to defense, and just starts like shimmying and dancing. Like, he's just on a different planet right now.
And I gotta say, I love that, because I've spent so much time in Oakland for the Golden State Warriors playoff runs these last 5 years. Mm-hmm. And I could just imagine there was a lot of people out there being like, that was hella cool. Oh man, it's so hyphy. Like, just the Bay Area vibe around Dame in that moment was just amazing. It was just funny. And, you know, I think he wound up, you know, giving a little bit of love to Too Short right in his post game interview with Jared mm-hmm. Greenberg as well. So, nice moment for the town out there. But yeah, look, I mean, if I had told you at the start of this season, Portland's the 8th seed, Lakers are the 1 seed, Portland's winning game one and Dame is dancing in LeBron's face, wouldn't you have thought, like, that seems like a terrible idea? Like, what are you doing? But that's not the vibe coming away from game one. It's like they're poking the bear, but they're not afraid of the bear. The bear's, you know, been tranquilized or something.
No, and I what I really loved is that, like, Terry Stotts is just getting away with playing Hassan Whiteside and Yusuf Nurkic at the same time. Like, in 2020, like, what is even happening? It's insane.
Great point, because Thaddeus emailed, and you referenced this earlier. He says, mm-hmm. You know, the Lakers' loss illuminated the flaws in their team. The Lakers just proved how poorly they built around LeBron. They got AD, then followed it up by signing JaVale, DeMarcus Cousins, and Dwight Howard. That's a legitimate bleeping joke. So Thaddeus is not happy. But is that the counter for LA? Do they have to go small and just ditch some of these center minutes? You know, in that case, you're actually letting Portland off the hook, and they can, you know, stay away from their two center lineups. But those two center lineups are out there because the Lakers insist on playing one of their big guys who is definitely not going to be a floor stretcher. You know, Dwight and JaVale are basically, you know, they have a 3 foot range. Their range is as long as their arm, right? And that lets Portland get away with a lot.
Yeah, and I think when you play two bigs, obviously the reason that you can't in today's league is on the defensive end, one of those guys usually needs to be at the 3 point line. But against the Lakers, that's really not a necessity. So you can get away with it. You can attack the glass and you can dominate in different ways. I mean, if you're the Lakers and you want to go small, this is where you get in trouble. Like the minutes are like you got to lean on all of a sudden Deion Waiters and J.R. Smith, two guys who Frank Vogel pretty much refused to play in game one, which really is super telling.
If I was Vogel, I might be playing like a 6-man rotation. I'm not even kidding. Like, there's so many guys on that roster that I do not want see touching the court in a serious playoff moment. And that's where they are right now. I don't know how you get away with 6. Maybe you go 7, possibly 8. But, like, there's a bunch of guys. It's tricky. And that's the thing with them going small. This dream idea that everybody had in the fall about, oh, LeBron, AD, and 3 shooters, it sounds great, but they're just 3 shooters short right now.
Yeah,
I don't know
the
where
shooters?
They find them.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, I just, there's not answers. And let me ask you a quick question, Ben. Over under 3 games that J.R. Smith will appear in this series?
I think he will appear in at least 3 games. But, I mean, that's a pretty low standard. There's lots of weird ways for guys to get in. I don't want to write the Lakers off completely here because I think LeBron can play better. Mm-hmm. Anthony Davis can play better. They did set the pace and tone. And I just think that they need to be force-feeding positive feedback to Danny Green from the 2014 title run. Just show him all his videos of, like, the 5 3-pointer games. That's, to me, that's kind of the X factor. And, look, I mean, people are going to point to Kuzma. Personally, I don't think I've ever trusted Kyle Kuzma for a second. It's possible that, you know, he will make me look bad. I just feel like a lot of this comes back to Danny Green. If they can get some spacing with Danny Green and Kentavious Caldwell-Pope can just shoot a little bit better. By the way, Michael, a couple years ago, I coined KCP as Kentavious Can't Play, and I'm feeling pretty good about that one right now.
That's a great nickname. I like that a lot. And before the bubble began, I wrote this column about making 46 predictions about the upcoming playoffs. And one of them was basically that Danny Green will have to be LA's 3rd most important player.
Totally agree.
That is just not going to happen. He looks like, I really don't like saying people are washed up and all that, but like, LeBron is kind of looking him off when he's wide open. Like, that started to happen in that Portland game. And I think it was right after maybe his, like, second air ball. Or it's like, you have Isaiah Thomas, former Celtic great, tweeting that Danny Green's foot speed just, like, can't keep up with anyone right now. And it's just, that's accurate analysis. I don't know where you go if Danny Green is not the answer. Maybe, you know, we haven't really mentioned Rondo's name yet. He's going to come back. But when Rondo, and I say this as like one of the biggest Rondo fans of all time, if Rondo in 2020 is the answer to you winning the NBA championship.
No, he's not.
It's not. It's not going to happen. So you can kind of cross that off the list.
After all this talk, I'm now waiting for LeBron to go out and put 45 up tonight. So we'll see if that takes place or if it doesn't. I do think that their salvation comes from him finding ways to just unlock Portland's defense, finding ways to get, you know, bully ball stuff going towards the basket, living on the free throw line, and just sort of de-emphasizing, the need for help from some of these questionable pieces. And hopefully those guys can just chip in just enough, a little bit more than they did in game one. And then maybe the Lakers will look like a different team. I thought in general their energy and their defense was pretty solid. They just had a couple brain farts in the fourth quarter. And again, it goes back to that's not what we think of for a number one seed. You know, we think of higher standards for that. So we'll see if they can get back there. I do feel like they're a little bit like the Napoleon Dynamite character, just living in the past slightly. Michael, back in March, we had this. You know, Rihanna used to come to our games. It was amazing. And right now, they're just like, we're in the bubble. No one's checking for us. It's awful. And I think they need to just let all that mental baggage go, reset. And I include LeBron in that. Just stop talking about the bubble environment. Stop talking about any of the other conditional factors here and just focus on hoop. You're a much better player than you've showed so far in the bubble and get back to it. All right, that's my personal pep talk for LeBron. I'm sure he's really excited to hear that before before game two. Let's shift gears to the other number one seed, Michael. Jimmy emailed in to say 35 points, 14 rebounds, and 4 assists. Boy, Giannis went off. Oh, wait a minute. What? That stat line wasn't from Giannis. If I'm reading this correctly, that's actually Nikola Vucevic against Giannis in a Game 1 win for Orlando. How could this be? Then Kyle followed up with another email. Just checking in on you, Ben. The Bucks dropped Game 1 to the Magic, and I can see you weeping openly on your walk to the Heat-Pacers game. Hopefully that heat and humidity allowed you a plausible excuse for your tear-soaked polo shirt. Boy, Kyle, it sounds like he set up some sort of a Truman Show camera, Michael. He's watching me on a video feed somewhere. So I'm excited, actually, for all these, for all these Magic fans to have their day. I think that Game 1 was basically their Super Bowl. That's how it kind of felt. Everything went very well. I do think that there's some stuff they can continue to, have success with going forward. I don't know. I still feel less panicky about Milwaukee than I do about the Lakers, but I'm judging from your condescending that you feel differently.
No, I think you should put a little more respect on Orlando's name, but I agree with you that I feel like certain aspects of that game were a total aberration, and Gary Clark just coming in shooting 12 threes, making 4 of them. Obviously Vucevic's line was very impressive. And then on the other end, Milwaukee, Chris Middleton didn't really show up. Brooke Lopez didn't really show up. They got some of the threes that they normally hit. They just didn't fall. Orlando was piping hot, particularly down the stretch. So, it was kind of an aberration. But then again, Aaron Gordon didn't even play. And maybe that's a good thing for Orlando in a weird way, where it kind of just discombobulates how you have to guard them, because there's more three-point shooting, respectable three-point shooting on the floor, and you don't have to really deal with the ways that he can kind of stifle an offense by himself with the dribbling and the pull-up twos and all that. So maybe that was kind of a little blessing in disguise for Orlando, but I mean, fundamentally, zooming out, Milwaukee is going to be fine in this series. I don't see them losing Game 2, which will be played later today. So by the time you listen to this, hopefully, yes, I am right, and they have tied the series. But no, I'm not nearly as concerned about Milwaukee as I am about the Lakers.
So here's where the concern comes in for me. I was talking to an executive about this down here in the bubble. And basically the premise is bubble basketball is not the same as the regular season for some of the reasons we've been describing. Teams are very comfortable shooting the basketball in these gyms. Lots of players have called it, shooter's gym. We saw Orlando shoot the ball very well in Game 1 and basically turn a lot of their attack over to that, just perimeter shooting with Vucevic and other guys, Terrence Ross and Gary Clark and all these different guys. If bubble ball is really premised upon more three-point shooting efficiency than regular season basketball, and scoring is up, which it has been, and you don't have home court advantage to limit, your opponent role players like teams in the past, if your defensive strategy is built around conceding threes and protecting the paint at all costs, does that now make you kind of on the wrong side of history? Does that math formula change? And this is something that we kind of predicted a couple months ago could potentially happen. Now, it could have also gone the other way. If nobody could shoot in these gyms and everybody was rusty from the four-month layoff, having the Bucks defensive style where you're just giving up all these threes would actually be a great thing, right? It's like, daring everyone to beat you from outside and just watching the clank fest. Mm-hmm. But it's been the opposite. And I guess if there's a cause for concern, if you're Milwaukee, Orlando is not the world's most potent offense. At least they weren't during the regular season. I think Milwaukee beat them by an average of 17 points per game. over the four regular season games, but there are going to be some teams down the road that can really shoot the basketball quite well. And if you're not adjusting your defense in any way, if you're just kind of playing that same strategy that you used during the regular season in the bubble, that could really kind of have the math formula work against you. And this executive told me, like, look, I wouldn't play that strategy just in general. Philosophically, he didn't like it during the regular season either, even though Milwaukee had amazing results. But he said he definitely wouldn't play it in the bubble because of the way the shooting performance has taken place. And he was basically recommending, look, they got to shake this thing up and just kind of rethink some of their principles here, because otherwise they're just going to get sniped. What do you think about this argument, this argumentation?
That's very funny, I think, to suggest that that Milwaukee should completely alter their highly successful defensive formula based off one game against the Orlando Magic. I'm not going to really go there just yet. And a lot of their personnel is built for that system. Obviously you could go small and you could switch and I think hold up pretty fine, but Brook Lopez is not going to be able to switch for 30 minutes, and he's a really big part of how they play, and his rim protection is huge. So, I mean, there will be games.
He got destroyed in game one, by the way, right?
Yes,
I mean, he was like a nothing on offense, and Vucevic just torched him. So that, to me, is kind of the central matchup concern. Like, you kind of have to tell Brook Lopez, like, you better show up in game two, bro. You better do it for all the Disney characters that you love. Like, you can't be letting Mickey and Goofy down. Like, it's time to really show up and step up and play a lot better. You know, get back to how he was looking during the seeding games, because, you know, at some point that's where you do have to shift things up. Like, if he can't get out to Vucevic and he's just raining threes, you have to think about different lineup looks, don't you?
Yeah, and I also think that there is a lot of value in just taking away the rim, which is what Milwaukee does better than anybody. And there will be games where Vucevic does not hit all of those pick-and-pop threes, where he does not make five of them, and where Gary Clark doesn't make four threes. And, Terrence Ross doesn't hit some of those really tricky shots off of pin-downs, and you don't foul three-point shooters as much as you did. I think that the strategy could also go the other way, where Milwaukee could just shoot a lot better than it did. And so much of our analysis ultimately comes down to how teams perform behind the three-point line, which is kind of a bummer and something that it's just like a different conversation. But I just go back to, like, this team has Giannis, this team has Chris Middleton, this team is knows how it wants to play, can really execute. It's not like they didn't execute their scheme. And over the long haul, they have faith in their scheme and in their coaching staff. So I can't get too worked up. If they lose in game two in the same way where Orlando just gets super hot again, I think then you should probably look to get a little bit more aggressive defensively, maybe get higher on the screens with the screening defender, maybe switch, maybe just play some different lineups. I don't know. But again, I just don't see that happening, so I wouldn't worry about it just yet.
Yeah, this is kind of the central point of this premise, is that Bud never adjusts anything, right? So I think that, you know, some of this argument is basically like, this is going to wind up falling on Bud's shoulders if this coach, who's notorious for never making adjustments, finds himself thrown into like the ultimate need for flexibility environment, which would be the bubble, and he's just not flexible. So we'll have to keep an eye on that for Milwaukee. Michael, let's shift gears to a team that I mentioned at the top of the episode, and that's the Philadelphia 76ers. They seem like they're basically ready to bounce out of the bubble. They are down 0-2, blown off the court in game two. Embiid started strong for Philadelphia in game two, but they just fizzled and faded. They had no real answers for Jason Tatum, who was shooting smooth and electric like he has been here over the last week or so. Things are basically looking completely green for Boston. And in Philly, you know, we heard Embiid poke at Brett Brown's defensive strategy, basically saying that him dropping on their defense is giving too many wide open looks to Jason Tatum, and basically saying it's too easy for Boston on offense. We heard Brett Brown questioned really directly by the Philadelphia media, essentially saying, like, why do you have any cause for hope? We heard Embiid say, well, the whole thing would be different if we were just going back to Philadelphia for game three. We heard Brett Brown say, hey, in a different universe, we would just be saying, Boston took care of business at home and now it's our turn. I mean, they're trying to use all these different slogans. Watching these games, every single player on their roster is disappointing. Embiid's been disappointing. Tobias Harris has been very disappointing. Al Horford's been disappointing. The younger guys, I'm not going to really hold them to account because, you know, whatever, they're being thrown into a tricky mix. It does feel like all of our boom or bust talk about the Sixers for the last 3 months has, you know, transitioned beautifully straight into a bust. And really the only, task now is determining how big the blast radius, right? I mean, who all gets impacted by this thing?
Yeah, the Sixers are not very good. I think that this is a really smart angle, which is to kind of figure out where they go from here. Because, look, like, the contracts that are on the books make it so that moving Al Horford or moving Tobias Harris or, you know, there's not a lot of assets to trade, even if you wanted to attach them to one of those contracts to move off of it. You could, I guess, theoretically try to get off, not really get off, but move Josh Richardson because he's pretty valuable and you don't want to have to pay him big money when his current contract expires. But he's also just like a super important contributor to a team that has no real three-point shooting and no real ball handling. So I don't really know where they go from here. And I can't really blame Brett Brown too much. I think that he's just, I've kind of been consistently saying this for the entire season, but he's just been dealt a really crappy hand with the players that he has. And like last night, playing a lot of lineups still with Horford and Embiid on the floor together, though, I will say, is kind of a little bit of an indictment. And maybe there were other options you could have gone to. You could have gone to Furkan Korkmaz a little bit more. You could have played Mike Scott. Alec Burks only playing 15 minutes after his really impressive game one performance was a head scratcher that was called out by the broadcast team during the game. So from that perspective, I guess you could blame Brett Brown, but like the issues here go a lot deeper. And
One way or another, they're not listening to him. So, I mean, he's going to be
gone. Yeah,
there's no way around that. I mean, here's how bad it is. If you're trying to talk about trading Tobias or Al Horford, you're going to have to attach assets, but they have very few interesting assets. I actually think the easiest way to trade Tobias Harris is to trade Joel Embiid and demand that the team taking on Embiid also takes on Harris, right? And in that scenario, then you're having to bring back a lot of money elsewhere. But like, it requires trading one of those main guys that people would actually want to get off those other contracts. So that's the kind of scope of the rebuild or the retooling effort that you're looking at if you're Philly. Michael, personally, if I were them, I would trade Embiid. When you're looking ahead to the next 3 or 4 years in the Eastern Conference, which are going to be his prime years, he is not going to be good enough to lead you to a title as the best player on a team. Kevin Durant's coming back. Giannis is looming. Toronto is just a machine at this point. And Boston is rising. And, of course, I'm not going to overlook them. I didn't mean to snub them as the last team in that group.
I was about to jump in. I'm glad that you you gave them their due.
It's painful, but I got around to it. You're just not going to be... I mean, even making the Eastern Conference Finals with Embiid as your best player, to me, is a questionable proposition right now. He did not deliver on his own preseason hype. Taking over in these kinds of environments as a center is just getting trickier and trickier year after year. They need to have tons and tons of shooting around him. They don't. His bad habits have only gotten worse, whether it's shot selection, conditioning, the health issues, which is not a bad habit, but it's just something that also looms. I'm just basically out on the Embiid experience, and I know he would still have significant trade value. They need a drastic overhaul in Philly. It's so obvious. Everyone can see it. My plan would be to try to trade Embiid and Harris, if possible, together. Try to get back whatever shooters and as little salary cap hit as possible for the future. Turn the keys over to Ben Simmons and just pray that by trading out Embiid, you lower expectations enough that you can make the playoffs with Simmons as your best player and people will sort of salute that as a victory. And then, you know, you wait another year and try to trade Horford once his contract gets a little bit easier for another team to swallow. That would be my strategy. But I think, dude, they're stuck, man. This is a – they're bagged up in a really bad way. And I think if I was ownership, I would be seriously considering changing my front office too.
I agree with a lot of what you said. I don't necessarily – I go back and forth between whether or not I would keep Embiid or whether or not I would keep Simmons. But I think it's just like – it's evident that the only way out of this is to trade one of them. And there's a lot of people very vocal who are still steadfast in belief that those two can work together and win a championship. I personally am not one of them. I don't think their games are compatible. I don't think they ever will be.
Bro, it's never going to happen. I'm watching this team. I mean, they wanted to leave the court before the game even ended last night. How are they going to win a title with these players? Come on.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. And, you know, Embiid's stat line was very impressive in game two, but to me, watching it, and Stan Van Gundy, like, really hit this point home multiple times throughout the game. Like, the shots that Embiid takes are, it's like funny money. It's like, it's not real. These are just mid-range fallaways that go in. They're not, it's like, I just don't understand why he's so insistent on taking them. And, you know, credit to Boston's defense for how they have swarmed him and all that, but like some of the shots he takes. Yeah,
let me say this: 34-10 is impressive. It looks okay, but his stat line was not that impressive because he was a -21 in 34 minutes, and they lost the game by 27 points. Right? I mean, they got smoked with him on the court. He is not even close to the best player in this series. Tatum is destroying him, and by the way, Embiid knows it.
Yeah, no, Tatum's clearly the best player in the series. There's just like, it's not even close. And I think it does speak to kind of the limitations of having a big man as your best player in today's NBA. And I think Embiid is great. I still think that from a skill and a talent perspective that he can be the best player in the world. I'm increasingly negative and down on that actually happening because, I mean,
forget about it. I'm sorry. There's just no possible way. This guy's got to turn his whole career around. He's got so many things he's got to change. First of all, he's got to get his body right. You know, second of all, he needs to play a higher IQ brand of basketball when it comes to decision-making, shot selection, turnovers, commanding of a defense, right? Those are so many things that he's going to have to change. And this guy's been around for a while. He's had time to show significant progress on these issues, and he just hasn't. Throw on top the injury concerns. Throw on top how many amazing playmakers and young players there are out there right now. I don't think he's even in the conversation. I just think these tectonic plates, Michael, have shifted. There have been earthquakes. There was a pre-earthquake era where Embiid was in this conversation for these kinds of things. That's in the past. You know, don't live in that, you know, 2018, 2019 era. It's done. I'm not saying his career is over. He's going to be an all-star level player for the next 7, 8, 9 years. But if you're telling me Embiid and Jokic, that used to be a conversation. There's no doubt in my mind which of those two players that I would have. If you're saying, okay, who do you have to build around in Philly, Embiid or Simmons? Simmons is not as good of a player as Embiid, but the expectations that come with Embiid and the other just baggage and body language and all that stuff we've seen this season, I would roll with Simmons if I was Philadelphia. And if they don't, I would be the first in line to try to trade for Simmons if I was a GM on another team. And you're just saying, look, you've got Tatum on the rise, Jaylen Brown on the rise, Kevin Durant coming back, Giannis is going to be Giannis, Pascal Siakam is getting better. This idea of like Joel Embiid lording over the universe is not happening.
I love this take. I'm jealous that I didn't really come up with it, and I might even just like steal it in a column. I hope you don't mind.
No, that's fine. I mean, you could just be like the aggregators, just do a little via Ben Golliver, just like all the aggregators, and just take all my content for free. It's fine.
But I knew, buy my
book, Michael. That's all I ask.
I know. I knew. Yeah, exactly. I knew you wouldn't mind. I guess like with Embiid real quick, a question that I have that I was thinking about during last night's game that I've never really considered before is, you know, when you look at superstars, when you look at, you know, top five, top six, top seven players, what makes them like members of that class is that they can directly and indirectly make life easier for those around them. And how does Embiid do that on the offensive end? Does he do that? I've never really like theoretically, you know, he's just this low post monster. You throw him the ball, it's an automatic double team. He kicks it out. It's a wide open three. Like, I don't know. I don't really feel that way anymore, particularly after watching Philadelphia play in the bubble without Ben Simmons. And I don't know. That's pretty concerning to me. I know this team isn't really built around him to accentuate all of his strengths, but he should be, given his talent level, someone who can make those around them better, and he just doesn't really do that.
I agree. I mean, the pieces around him are really tricky fits. I don't want to blame him for their entire situation. I'm being hard on him because I think the hype got really, really high at times over the last couple of years, and I just don't think it's warranted based on how he's been playing here. I think his heart is generally in the right place. I do think he needs to recommit a little bit to the sport, and I do think that he just needs a change of scenery and a new voice. I just don't think him and Brett are on the same page in the same way anymore. You know, you look at some other functional coach-player relationships. I mean, Damian Lillard came out and was like, I want to play well so my coach doesn't get fired. Like, that's like actually on his mind as a philosophy. Do you think Embiid, when he's going for 35 and 10, is like, oh man, I've got to do it to save Brett Brown's job? There's just no way. I mean, that's not happening. So I think it's time for a major shakeup. If I was Philly, I would seriously consider trading him this summer. And I would also consider getting a front office that knows what it's doing. That's just throwing that out there as an idea. All right, let's shift gears here. Javier, he writes, after tonight's Luka Doncic game, a thought came to my mind. I had to check with other basketball junkies who I call friends before I hit the flame switch for this take. Here comes the heater. Is Luka Doncic giving out GOAT vibes? Is this kid for real? Is Doncic a GOAT? I asked all my friends. They replied like I was a prophet about to be stoned to death. But here's my follow-up. He could potentially be a top 10 all-time player by the time he finishes his career. So he's moving the goalposts within his own questions, Javier. I mean, look, trying to put Luka over MJ, it's going to be kind of a tough sell with his one career playoff win at this point, which actually occurred last night. But just six more titles to go, Michael, six more. But what is Luka's ceiling here after we've watched this? I mean, he's smashing all these records for, you know, scoring at his age, and he's scaring the daylights out of the Clippers, kind of getting whatever he wants offensively for himself and for his teammates on behalf of Dallas. Is Javier out of control? Is he really this prophet being stoned by his friends? Are you ready to back him up, Michael? What's Luka's ceiling?
Whew, yeah. greatest of all time is... it's a little too high for me, I would say. I think Luka is just breathlessly entertaining, and beyond his years in skill and production, and we just talked about guys who make their teammates better. Luka Doncic makes his teammates better. So hats off to him. I do think one thing about, you know, just watching the Dallas Mavericks play all season long that has been a little, like, I don't want to say this is a dig on Luka at all, but it is interesting just, like, how fine they are when he doesn't play. And you, like, look at that roster, it's not really, there's not, like, a lot of ball creators, there's not a lot of guys who can initiate offense efficiently. There's Kristaps, and that's wonderful, and Kristaps plays really well without Luka. But, like, for example, in game two, when they won, Luka has five fouls, exits the game early in the fourth quarter. Typically, you know, like that should have been an opportunity for the Clippers to really make a run, right? And instead, like, Dallas's bench just destroys, and they move the ball incredibly well. Their assist rate with Luka off the floor is higher than when he's on it. Their offense is better in the bubble with Luka off the floor. So these are just, you know, it's not Luka's fault that his teammates really work well together. and it's not his fault that Rick Carlisle's bench mobs are traditionally juggernauts. But I do think it's interesting. And I'm like literally giving away a column that I hope to write. I'm going to pitch it as soon as this podcast is over on this subject. But it is something that I've been thinking about. And I don't think like this is, I'm like tap dancing here over whether or not that like if Michael Jordan would ever be in a situation where when he
basically
sits,
what you're saying is Luka's not the GOAT, the Mavericks are better without Luka. That's your take? Unbelievable.
That this is the take that I avoided from saying out loud, and I don't believe it, but I just think it's interesting, that's all.
Michael, come on now. Look, I think first of all, we spent so much time talking about Houston's amazing system, the small ball. It's so crazy. It's so different. Dallas's system is just as effective and also just as interesting, right? Their space is amazing. And what's really fun is that every once in a while, they'll just counter with Boban, just dropping him in the middle of an ocean of space to just like take down opposing matchups every once in a while, which is just like such an interesting, like counter jab or whatever you want to call it. But I think that you might be underselling a little bit the quality of their ball handling playmakers. Look, I am not the world's biggest Trey Burke fan. I think Seth Curry is definitely an interesting player, not the world's greatest. And THJ has some shake to him off the dribble, but I think it's just a situation where like you can have those role players finding success because there is so much space and because they do play together and for each other. With the great vibe. And I give Luka a lot of credit for the vibe around that team. I mean, he's clearly their leader already. He's got an amazing competitive personality and energy to him. I think it's infectious. And, you know, they're ready to rock even when he's on the bench because they know exactly what they're trying to do. They're all on the same page and there's lots of room to operate. So I'm not hyping up any of those one individual players as like amazing, you know, like third scoring options behind Luka and Porzingis. But I do think they've got a number of different guys they can, you know, break down defenders off the dribble and take advantage of all that paint space.
Yeah, no, that's totally fair. And I guess this is just like entirely, besides the point of the original question, which is can Luka be the GOAT, which I guess
Javier,
I'm just gonna,
chill, okay, man? Just chill.
Yeah,
not yet.
But here's, I'm just going to say no, yeah.
Here's the fun part about that, though. I mean, Luka comes out and, he's saying three more. That's his message after the Game 2 win against the Clippers. Mm-hmm. Like, again, it's no fear factor. There's a lot of the same confidence that we saw in Portland is developing in Dallas. They feel like they could win this series. They don't think they're just happy to be here. I think that's an awesome mentality, and again, it starts with Luka. Porzingis had a hilarious comment essentially saying that, you know, he tells himself, like he mentally coaches himself, that he's already a champion, that he deserves to be here. And again, this is a player who's won one career playoff game now. So, you know, they're arriving maybe a little bit faster than they expected, or at least they're booking their travel a little bit early. But good. Ride this wave of positivity. You know, it's rare in the NBA. You compare how happy Dallas seems to the misery of Philly or some of these other teams out there that just haven't been able to put it together. It's a good time to be a Mavericks fan and a good time to be a Mavericks player as well. All right, let's keep this thing moving. We have a question from Brendan, and he says, you guys have got to stop with the disrespectful Nuggets dismissal. And really, Michael, he's talking to me. He says, I would understand if you only spoke about the true contenders, but you guys spend ages discussing your cute stories like Portland, Dallas, and Boston. Well, we have talked about those guys a lot. He continues, Denver is an exciting young team who will make a much bigger impact than Portland or Dallas, yet those teams get all your attention. Yes, the Nuggets have had defensive issues in the bubble, but so have all these teams. I'm not saying that they can win the title, but if they get the full starters back, Jokic is phenomenal, Murray enjoys the big stage, Millsap is a solid defensive veteran, if MPJ can keep shooting to cause headaches, Torrey Craig and hopefully Gary Harris will be able to defend the wings and knock down threes, and then you've got a nice picture altogether. If they're firing on all cylinders, this team can challenge the Clippers. No worries. So it's a strong argument for Brendan on behalf of what I assume is his favorite team. Unfortunately, right after he sent this email, they gave up 120-plus to the Jazz, and now that series is even. I do think that defensive issues are different than every team in the bubble's defensive issues. Like, I think it's obviously injury related. They don't have their starting wings, but that depth at that spot is just killing them. And, you know, I'm not sure what their counter is. I mean, isn't this just sort of like a endless Christmas for Donovan Mitchell going against the Denver Nuggets?
Yeah. First of all, I want to say that the Celtics aren't a cute story. I have to. There's like a part of me that wouldn't be able to sleep at night if I didn't speak up and just and swat that down real quick.
I cannot wait for the Raptors to knock them out in the second round. I just cannot wait for that to happen. But continue.
That's when I'm going to go on vacation, by the way, so find a guest host.
Thanks for the warning.
Yeah, no, I mean, the Denver Nuggets have the worst defense in the bubble. And so, I mean, you can't just like gloss over that. And there are reasons for it, as you mentioned, like Will Barton leaving the bubble, not being around. Gary Harris, who might have been pound for pound their best defender during the regular season and last year, too. He is out. I don't even know why he's out, to be honest with you, but he's not playing. Paul Millsap on the defensive end, you know, Paul Millsap just like, he has these moments of, you're like, oh, that's, he's like, this is underrated Paul Millsap. And then there are moments where you're like, this is a guy who is clearly on the downswing of his career. So you kind of are just rendered with, you know, Torrey Craig and PJ Dozier and these lineups that have Jeremy Grant a little bit out of position. Michael Porter Jr. is their leading scorer in the bubble. And also, like, arguably, I don't know, I sent this text to someone a couple days ago, and I don't know if it's too hot for the podcast, but I'm just going to say it anyway. I think Michael Porter Jr. might be the worst defender in the bubble. And so when you have to play him and you're Mike Malone and he's kind of giving you so much offense and he's shooting the hell out of the ball and just he's been incredible in a lot of different ways, but his defense is just, you can really attack him on and off the ball. So I think there are issues
here. He struggles to slow both opposing wings and germs equally. I mean,
yeah, exactly. So like Jamal Murray's offense at times in this playoff series has been just scintillating. And, you know, when he goes basket for basket against Donovan Mitchell, it's like truly been some of the most entertaining basketball that we've seen so far in the playoffs early on.
Let me ask you, though, sure. Has Murray given you a little Trae Young vibes where it's like, I'm really excited for your points, but like, can we like keep track of how many you're personally giving up on the other end and just kind of like use that to kind of counterbalance and maybe like, you know, adjust? It's almost like a currency exchange rate where like he's just balling out, but then on the other end, he's just giving it all back. I don't know.
No, I think Jamal Murray is in a different class defensively than Trae Young. I get what you're saying for sure. And he's hurt by the fact that some of the guys who, you know, he's been a participant in some really good defensive lineups, but just when those pieces aren't there, there's just this domino effect where he has to guard different players that he normally wouldn't. And so he looks worse than I think he is, if that makes any sense. But yeah, like you're missing too many pieces to be, I guess, like I don't want to completely discount the Nuggets, but I'm also saying like in response to the end of that email where the Nuggets can handle the Clippers, that's just not in this universe. That's not happening.
Right. And I think that there was some ifs baked into his explanation, and like mm-hmm. Gary Harris is a gigantic if, and if he comes back and plays like he played in February, then okay. Like I'm more interested in this argument, Brendan. If not, and they continue to give up 120-plus to Utah, which has not been the world's most incredible offense at any point this season, I would be pretty nervous if I were them. And I think that's going to be a long series, one that I'm getting more interested in. We had another question from Morgan who says, hey, Ben, I know you said you wouldn't talk about the Nuggets and Jazz, but Donovan Mitchell did score 57 points, and Jamal Murray was going off too. Couldn't you try to talk about it a little bit? Okay, Morgan, I feel you. I feel you. I hear you guys out there. The game one was truly sensational, back and forth stuff. But also keep in mind here, from the Jazz's perspective, like Mike Conley re-entering into a series where nobody can guard anybody and he can hit open threes playing off of Mitchell, I feel like that's arguably an even bigger threat if you're Denver. I don't know. Are you ready to pick Utah in this series by any chance, Michael? Or how are you feeling after seeing these teams go back and forth for two games?
I honestly still have no feel whatsoever because the way
I agree. And I don't like to be the takesman who says I don't know, but I don't know on this one.
No. Like in game two, Jordan Clarkson is just a fireball. And so, you know, thinking that that is going to sustain itself and carry over, I'm not going to be that person. On the other hand, like, Utah looks really good. Mitchell looks incredible. And the way he's getting buckets, the way he's setting up teammates, the ball movement that Utah is showing is very impressive. And so, like, and I just want to real quickly, like, also shout out Rudy Gobert, who on these pick and rolls, when he catches the ball at around the free throw line and he needs to make a decision as a passer, he's just like I know he's not Jokic, but he made this one wraparound left-handed pass to the corner to a shooter. I forget who it was. That was just like, that was very Jokic-esque. And I didn't know he had that type of vision or ability in him. So if he's making passes like that, it just opens up the offense completely and gives them more dimensions. So I do like the Jazz maybe a little bit more than I did before the series started. But like, I don't want to disrespect Jokic. I don't want to disrespect... I'm trying to think of like who the second best player is on Denver. And I don't even know. So... maybe I am leaning Jazz. I don't even know, man.
Yeah, I think it does, you know, kind of go back to Jokic here. He needs to reassert himself. Gobert won that matchup in game two in ways that I didn't really expect. So, you know, pressure falls to him. And, you know, I think he's got some help. I mean, they've definitely been able to score the ball pretty well overall. I think that the biggest question for this entire series just comes down to Denver's defense. Can they get back to respectable? If not, I think they're going home. I think it's that level of bad. All right, we're going to close up here quickly with two questions just about the bubble. Ryan says, one of the many unusual byproducts of playing in a bubble is that it allows players to attend other games. Do you think it's an advantage for players to watch their potential playoff opponents live action? I know teams have advanced scouts and that players sift through tons of tape in preparation for each series, but I'm wondering if you think being able to scout teams live could help players in the playoffs. We haven't seen a ton of this in the playoffs. It seems like the teams are much more locked into their own schedules, Ryan. Guys here and there may be going to attend like a former teammate's game, something like that. I'm not really seeing like, you know, guys showing up with iPads, you know, breaking down clips in real time as they're watching these games. I think that they're so used to watching opponents on TV, they're probably doing that from the comfort of their hotel room, and they're also probably trying to get downtime, you know, in the course of their own series. I have seen a number of executives do it. You know, Sean Marks was out there scouting Sixers Celtics last night. Maybe he's trying to put together a Joel Embiid trade offer. Who knows? I mean, this, you know, that's completely me fabricating that, but you know, he was there taking it in for himself. Maybe he's expecting that they're going to upset you know, Toronto, and he wants to have a first look at Brooklyn's second round opponent.
Sure.
Sam Presti has been living in the gym, Michael. He's been at game after game after game after game, and so you're seeing a few rival executives taking a look at other teams in person, but for the most part the player turnout has been lower at the playoff games than it was, you know, during the seeding games. And I would also say just the feel on campus has been quieter in general. It's almost like a, you know, a switch flipped for the playoffs, and all of a sudden a lot of the goofy games and all that stuff mm-hmm. that was going on, everything just kind of settled down. Everybody got into this like kind of more professional, it's like the, you know, summer's over type of vibe, school's back on. That's how it felt here in the bubble once the playoffs started, and we'll see if that's how it continues. But I do think some of these teams are, you know, and coaches especially, are facing legit pressure with these series. I mean, there are expectations hanging over these teams, and so it's only natural that I think people are kind of getting a little bit more buttoned up.
There aren't really enough hours in the day to scout a current opponent in a playoff series. So, I mean, first of all, it's really not even the player's responsibility to deal with this sort of thing. So them letting their mind wander to a different potential opponent while they're in the middle of a battle against someone else, I don't think that would be smart. It doesn't surprise me at all that executives are, like, you know, looking forward and attending games and scouting players and getting a feel for just the general competition because that's their job. It reminds me of, you know, in summer league when you see just everybody sitting in the gym watching games from sundown to sunup, or sunup to sundown. That's probably the more accurate description. But yeah, so I don't really think that a player, it would be beneficial at all for a player to watch another series in person. Like, I just don't think that letting your mind wander to something else when you really need to be 100% locked in on your current matchup would do you any good.
Yeah, and they have practices and shoot-arounds that they've got to deal with as well. So, I mean, they have busy days here, and there are no extra days off. It should also be mentioned. Teams are playing every other day throughout the playoffs, so their schedules are pretty tight. Last question here. Tommy says, I've been so pleased to see how players have more space on the sidelines and end lines to go for balls that are going out of bounds while not being interfered with by fans and media members sitting on the floor during these bubble games. I understand that stadiums and teams are trying to squeeze as many people as they can and get as much money as they can, but man, wouldn't it be better if guys weren't restricted to such a small space where they run the risk of injury colliding with camera equipment, NBA owners, or mouthy fans on the basketball court? Great question from Tommy. Michael, have you noticed that too?
I think so. I mean, honestly, it didn't really come into my mind when I was watching these games. I guess, like, you know, we always talk about the cameramen and women who sit along the baseline and the potential for serious injury. I think one play that comes to mind is at the end of the 2016 finals when LeBron almost dunked Draymond Green into oblivion and then kind of landed on the baseline and he crashed into a camera operator and was like, oh my God, is LeBron okay? That was just like a really high profile moment where you're kind of just like, why are these guys sitting here? But I haven't really seen players behaving differently because of it. I still think that it's like high octane, you know, they'll dive for loose balls regardless. They'll dive into the stands regardless. And frankly, like, I kind of miss the energy that's created by those quote unquote mouthy fans who sit courtside. You know, they bring a different type of energy, and maybe more so in the past when they all weren't like Fortune 500 CEOs. But no, I haven't really like noticed anything too different besides just the obvious.
Yeah, I mean, I think it looks cleaner in person and on TV without having people there. But I also agree that this is never going to change. You know, the NBA does make lots and lots of money off of those seats and the proximity for them. They're trying to bring people as close as possible. So I think, Tommy, enjoy it while you've got it like this. And I haven't noticed a major change in player behavior either. You know, I think they're chasing basketballs either way, but I do like the safety factor that's involved here where they don't have to worry about, you know, trying to land properly or knocking a beer out of someone's hands or, you know, having their tailbone land on a camera and, you know, double over in pain. I think it's a better basketball experience, just a cleaner basketball experience here. But ultimately, like, this sport is not just about basketball. It's about the entertainment factor and all the money it can generate and everything else. And we will be going back to a world where, you can heckle heckle that Sixers bench from 10 feet away, Michael, once you get the opportunity, say in 2022. And I think on that note, we should wrap this thing up, Michael. Guys, you can email us, openfloormail@gmail.com, openfloormail@gmail.com. I'm sure we said something today that's going to come back and bite us 24 hours later. That's how it works in the playoffs. So let us know what it was. Push back on any of our takes. Defend your favorite player. Lash out at Michael. Whatever you want to do, we're trying to hear it. Michael, they can find us on Apple Podcasts by searching for Open Floor. That's two words. When they find our page, scroll down. It will say rate and review. Tap 5 stars. It's just that easy to help us spread the word. Now, Michael's on Instagram at Michael Villas and Victor Pina. He's also on Twitter, same handle, Michael Villas and Victor Pina. I'm on Instagram at Ben.Golver, on Twitter at Ben Golver. If you go to my Twitter page, you will find a link to pre-order a book. It's called Bubble Ball. I will be documenting my journey and my stay down here in the NBA's Orlando bubble for the next 3 months. That book will come out next May. I'm pretty excited about it. I'm working with Abrams Press on it. If you could pre-order it, it would certainly help me a lot. I will be donating a big chunk of the pre-order money to charity just as a show of gratitude for everyone out there who's supporting the project. So More details to come on that, but please go ahead and give that a look. All right, Michael. Until next week, I'll talk to you.
Talk soon, Ben.